Okay, like Darian, I'd also like to talk about data coming from one of the Tevatron experiments, in this case CDF, and I'll also be talking about some of the phenomenological tools that we used in run two, as well as the improvements that we'd hope to see during the course of this workshop. Now, Michelangelo claims that I only have one talk and that I give this same talk over and over again. So if you've seen some aspects of this talk before, please bear with me. And in fact, you'll see that Darian and I have chosen many of the same transparencies. So you're going to see many of his transparencies repeated here. So in that sense, I'm also carrying coals to Newcastle, or to be more specific, to Durham. I don't know if James is in the audience, but that was, yes, that was there for his benefit. So again, Tevatron in run two, everyone knows this, that we have a shorter bunch spacing time, which means completely new electronics for both CDF and D0. We have an increased center of mass energy, and we also have an increased luminosity, although not to the extent that we would like to the state. So this is the CDF detector. We have new silicon. We have a new central tracker. We have a new N-plug calorimeter. And again, we have completely new electronics for every calorimeter, every detector in CDF. So here's the CDF tracker. It's performed very well recently. You can see it looks nice and shiny. There's a nice JSI peak here. Oops. Have to watch what button I click. There's a nice B signal shown in the bottom right-hand corner. One of the very powerful experimental tools that we have is being able to trigger on tracks. For example, here is at level one. You know, we have the XFT, where we can select tracks of a certain momentum range. And at level two, we can look for secondary vertices. So we can trigger on heavy flavors, charm, and bottom, you know, on the trigger level. So this is very powerful, not only for bottom physics, but also for charm physics as well. So we find that we're rapidly becoming the repository of the largest charm signal in the world. Oops. This is the first time I've used this, so still have to figure out the buttons. If you look at the data taking, of course, this is the turn-on period here. You can see that there's some learning curve, but now we're plateauing of greater than 80 to 90% efficiency range. So this is the data that we've taken so far during run two. And again, this is sort of the commissioning phase here, first data for analysis. And this is the data that we're using for physics. So we've recorded 220 inverse picobarons of physics quality data up to the end of August 2003. There's been a shutdown at sort of the end of August, beginning of September, that we're just recovering from now. So this is our main data set of 220 inverse picobarons, although now both CDF and D0 are taking data again. So we consider this to be a complete data set. It's a natural stopping point, you know, just because there was this long shutdown, there's the ability to consolidate. In addition, this is twice the data that we took in run one. So all of the physics groups are planning to publish analysis on this data set. But unfortunately, most of the results using this full data set, or something close to the full data set, are going to be blessed for the winter conferences. So this isn't considered enough of a priority. So most of the results that I'm going to present here are going to be with less luminosity than the full 220 inverse picobarons. So the time scale for publication vary from the short term for these analysis of the next few months to the end of the year. And this is due to the different degrees of sophistication required by each particular analysis. And we expect to publish greater than 50 papers on this data set. So the Tevatron Collider serves as an arena for precision tests with photons, leptons, WZs, jets. So these are the highest Q-squared scales that are currently achievable, and this is a good place to look for new physics. There's a sensitivity to parton distributions over a wide kinematic range. There's lots of two-scale problems where you can test the effects of soft gluon resummation. And you can do precision measurements, such as looking for the W mass, top mass, sensitivity to the Higgs mass. So dynamics is governed mostly by QCD, with electroweak corrections being important for precision physics. So there's a variety of programs available for comparison of data to theory and or predictions. So at the tree level, we use programs like AlpGen, CompEP, GRACE, MadGraph. Then we also have parton shower Monte Carlo, such as Herwig and Pythia. And there's the Lazouche Accord that allows us to go between the tree level calculations and the parton shower Monte Carlos. There are higher order calculations like EKS, JETRAD, DIRAD, WGRAD, ZRETGRAD. And again, this is a relatively new development where we have parton shower of a program like Herwig and next to leading order calculations that can couple to Herwig so that you have a complete event in the final state with the correct next to leading order description. Unfortunately, this is sort of a process by process work that has to go on in order to put some new physics into MC at NLO so that CDF and D0 are coming up with a wish list of what we'd like to see Stefano and Brian working on for the next, 10 years or so. And again, there's also resummed calculations that, such as ResBoss. So it's important to know the strengths and weaknesses of each of these different types of programs. And one of the goals of this workshop is to improve these tools and their applications not only to the Tevatron, but also to the LHC. So let me start with exotics. There are many things that don't exist at the Tevatron, just as there are many things that won't exist at the LHC. And the job of CDF so far is to try to not find them more precisely than we didn't find them in run one. So there's a large number of analyses. You can see there's 19 analyses in advanced stages. There's 20 other analyses. So here's just one example of looking for a Z-prime and Randall-Sundrum gravitons, where you look for a narrow resonance at high mass consisting of opposite sign dileptron pairs. And if you look, at the data, you don't see anything obvious that stands out to you as a high mass narrow resonance. So the only thing that's left is just to set the limit. And again, here are the limits for a Z prime under various assumptions for the type of Z prime, and again, also for the graviton production. And again, we're getting to the point where we're setting better limits than we did in run one, again, with the higher luminosity and the better detector that's available. Let me turn next to electroweak physics. There is a number of bread and butter baseline measurements, such as the WZ cross section, the ratio of the cross sections, looking at lepton universality, forward-backward asymmetry, and there's also the aspect of looking at the improvement of electroweak parameters, such as the W charge asymmetry, diboson production, and the W mass measurement. So if you consider W decaying into a lepton and neutrino, this is a very clean signature with an isolated lepton and high missing ET. It has a large cross section, a good signal to background ratio. So as Darian says, this is an ideal calibration tool for precision measurement. You can consider it as the standard candle for high PT physics. So here, for example, is the transverse mass distribution looking for W decaying into leptons. Here are the samples based on, again, this is 72 inverse picobarons, so this is somewhat limited sample compared to the 220 inverse picobarons that we'll be publishing on so far from run two. Here are the cross sections that are measured, again, with these samples here, and these are the number of events that we're going to expect in two inverse femtobarons. You can also look at Z decaying into two leptons. And again, it's a very unique signature. They're isolated leptons of opposite charge. There's very little background. You can trigger these on multiple channels, so it's a good way of testing the efficiency of your detector, as well as looking at the physics involved. So if you look at the Z mass distribution shown here, where Z goes to electron, of course, you have a very narrow, very sharp peak. Again, this is looking at 72 inverse picobarons. And here are the samples in the electron and the muon modes. Here are the cross sections that are measured, along with the comparison of the cross sections measured in D0. This is the standard model prediction. So Darian already showed this plot here, showing the sigma times branching ratio for W production, as well as the same thing for Z production. You can see the increase with the center mass energy. And again, we have a higher cross-section in run two, as you would expect, from the higher center mass energy. It's not very much because the W is in a very massive particle. and neither is the Z. You can also have other measurements, for example, looking at the ratio of the W to Z cross-section and using some input from theory and from other experiments. You can measure, for example, the width of the W, and again, you're in good agreement with the standard model prediction. So again, Darien has already talked about this, so I'll just touch on this, which is that with modern PDFs, the QCD predictions have smaller errors than the normalization to the total inelastic cross-section. This could be very tricky, this idea of the measurement of the luminosity. And as Darien mentioned, CDF and D0 use the different values in run 1. So as a result, all the cross-section measurements in CDF and D0 are going to be different in run 1 by 5%, even if we're measuring exactly the same thing. And this is because there are two measurements of the total inelastic cross-section by CDF and E811 that differ at the 3 sigma level. Now, there's a Tevatron working group that's working on deriving a common value for the inelastic cross-section for run 2 so that we're going to normalize to the same thing. But as far as I know, they're still working and haven't arrived at a final number. So an idea that many people have talked about is to, in addition to quoting an absolute cross-section for all the processes that we're measuring in run 2, as well to measure the ratio of each cross-section compared to the W cross-section, you know, which is something that could be measured experimentally very well, and it has small theoretical errors. So I think the idea is that the cross-section should be quoted that way as well. For all the cross-sections quoted so far, CDF uses for run 2 inelastic cross-section of 60.7 millibarons, and D0 uses a value of 57.6. So it was an exercise that Terry Wyatt went through at the Lepton Photon, where he normalized both CDF and D0 to 60.7 millibarons. And again, you end up with the cross-section shown here, again, already shown by Darien. Tevatron average cross-section is 2.69 nanobarns for the W cross-section. And it's 258 picobarns for the Z cross-section. Now again, there's this question that's very important about the theoretical uncertainty for the W and the Z cross-section. So if you look from leading order to next to leading order, there's quite an increase in the cross-section. And we also have next to next leading order cross-sections available for W and Z production. You can see that it's, you know, somewhat smaller, but still it's not a not insignificant change in the cross-section. So we feel that as far as the higher order calculations are concerned, we're in fairly good shape because we have the next and next to leading order calculations available to us. It's also the question of PDF uncertainties. So there's two groups that have predictions right now, three groups with Walter, GKK. So the CTEC, using a criterion for delta chi-square of 100, predicts an uncertainty for the W cross-section of the order of 4%. MRST uses a criteria of 50 for a 90% confidence level and predicts an uncertainty of the W cross-section for 2%. So again, we have different ranges of predictions because we have these different criteria about what an appropriate value of delta chi-squared is. The one thing I would point out is that the CTEC cross-sections are approximately 2% higher for W cross-sections than the MRST cross-sections are. So you have two groups both doing reasonable things that can still differ in their central values by 2%. So there's been a great deal of recent activity on the part of PDF fitting groups, such as CTEC, MRST, GKK, Elekin, to provide PDF uncertainties. There's two main techniques, the Hessian-Lagrange multiplier, which James is going to talk about in more detail during his talk. Just for the CTEC, since that's the one I'm most familiar with, there's 20 free parameters in the fit. So in the Hessian method, you end up with a 20 by 20 matrix, which has to be diagonalized. Each eigenvector direction corresponds to some linear combination of PDF parameters, with the large eigenvalues corresponding to the directions that are very precisely determined. For example, those that are dealing with the valence quark distributions, and the small eigenvalues corresponding to directions that are very poorly determined, such as the Hayek gluon distribution. And again, this is something that we're going to be considering in this workshop in a great deal of detail during January, especially next week whenever Wookie is going to be visiting and James is going to be still here as well. So this is an aside for the effective use of PDF uncertainties. Again, they're important both for precision measurements as well as for studies of potential new physics. Most Monte Carlo or matrix element programs have central PDFs built in, or they can interface to PDFlib. But if you want to determine the PDF uncertainty for a particular cross-section, that involves requiring the use of many PDFs. For example, with the CTAC Hessian technique that requires 40 parton distributions, GKK of the order of 100, MRST, 30 PDFs. So it's too clumsy to include grids for the calculation of all these PDFs with Monte Carlo programs. And so from here came, from this idea here, this problem, came the Lesueche Accord number 2, which allows the specification of each PDF by a few lines of information. So Monte Carlo programs performing the evolution. There's a new version of this program that was an outgrowth of Lesueche 2003, which allows all the grids from all the error PDFs to be kept in memory at the same time. So that allows for a much faster calculation of PDF uncertainties for any cross-section. So I'll show some results from this later on in my talk, and John Campbell is also going to be talking about this, and I'm sure in some of his predictions from MCFM. So Walter Gila is the one who started this, and Mike Wally from Durham has taken over the maintenance of this program. All right, if you look at the W and Z cross-sections, of course, as you can imagine, the uncertainties of the W and Z cross-sections are very correlated. You know, here are the 40 predictions from the CTEC error sets. You can see they lie along this diagonal line. And here I've just taken Terry Wyatt's summer average, you know, and just done something very simplistic, adding the errors in quadrature. So you can see it's a little bit offset to the right, but again, the errors are still very large. So WMAS is one of the most interesting analyses to be done at the Tevatron, but it's also one of the most difficult. You know, you can fit to the transverse mass distribution or to the Jacobian peak of the electron PT distribution. So you need to know PDFs, you know, in order to get the acceptance right, the WPT distribution, all the radiative corrections, again, as Daria talked about. Now, as the statistical errors decrease, then small systematic errors, both in the experiment as well as in the theory, become more and more important. And in particular, in run 2, we expect an error of the order of 30 MeV. This means that we're going to require a great deal of theoretical as well as experimental input. One of the things that's important, you know, is QCD effects in electroweak events. So you can have the effects of soft gluon emission, both in the case of the Z, where you can measure that very well because you can measure the four vector of the Z very precisely, you know, as well as in the W, where you can't measure it so well because of the neutrino that carries off energy and momentum. So here's a result from run 1 that shows the ZPT distribution, you know, along with Pythia. And there's a paper here that actually discusses some of this in more detail. And one of the things that you'd like to know, you know, is not only, you know, sort of what's the central prediction for what the ZPT distribution looks like or the WPT distribution, but you'd also like to know what is the uncertainty in that PT distribution. Just as you asked the question about the uncertainty for, you know, the cross-section, you know, or how does the PDF uncertainty affect the W mass? And so here's an exercise that is from a forthcoming CTEC paper, and again, that Wookie will discuss in more detail when he visits next week, which is exploring this different uncertainties for the ZPT distribution and the WPT distribution using the CSS formalism to come up with an estimate of what the theoretical problem or theoretical error is going to be from that source. Speaking of resummation, so, you know, there's lots of QQ bar initial state, you know, objects like the W and the Z that you can look at, but we're also measuring diphoton production, you know, in at the Tevatron, and that's coming both from QQ bar annihilation into diphotons as well as glu-glu. So it turns out that the glu-glu calculate the next leading order. The corrections are actually quite large. So if you look in the peak region for where we measure the diphoton data, that the glu-glu process is actually appreciable of the order of 40% or more. And unless the front row leaps out of their seats to strangle me, I should say that this is based on a calculation that's done by Carl, Lance, and Zvi, but this is sort of a private communication from Carl to me because he applied this to the Tevatron rather than to the LHC where it was originally done. So again, it's going to be very interesting to compare the full calculation both to the mass distribution as well as to the QT distribution for the diphoton pair. But again, something that has to be done is the resummation calculation to next to leading order for blue-blue as well as for QQ bar. But it's going to be a very interesting testing ground because, of course, the Higgs production at the LHC is from blue-blue scattering. And, you know, here's a compilation I made of all the predictions for, you know, Higgs production for the, what the PT distribution is going to look like. And again, it's sort of arguing in a vacuum until you actually have Higgs data to compare to. But since there is glue-glue goes to diphoton, that is a way we can try to test some of these resummation formalisms. And again, we can also look at things like di-boson coupling. So for example, in this case, it's WW events, where you have a signature of opposite charge, high PT isolated leptons. And again, here is the opening angle between, Here's the opening angle here plotted versus the missing ET. So you expect 9.2 events. We see 5 events. So we actually see a few events less than what the standard model expectation is. So we end up with a cross-section that's shown here that's in agreement with the standard model. So no signs of new physics from this arena yet. Now we come to a subject near and dear to my heart, which is jet production at the Tevatron. I mean, nowhere else is the increase in the center of mass energy appreciated so much, you know, as in the jet production. So for example, if you look at the cross-section at square root of S of 1.96 compared to 1.8 GeV, that's a factor of 2 at 400 GeV, a factor of 5 at 600 GeV. In fact, you know, with two inverse femtobarons, even though this is kind of a fuzzy slide here, then we're going to be able to measure the cross-section out of the order to the order 600 GeV. That's quite an appreciable difference because in run one, we sort of stopped right around here in the low 400s. We're going to be able to get out to 600 GeV in run two because of the effect of the increased center mass energy. And just to prove it, you know, here's our maybe most spectacular jet event in which we have, you know, a dijet event and both of these jets have energies greater than 600 GeV. In fact, you know, this doesn't have any satanic significance, I think, but maybe we should change our direct jet corrections by an epsilon so it doesn't come out to 666 anymore. So if you look at the run two jet cross section, again, this is not using the full 220, but it's a little bit closer than the other analysis, 177. You can see that we're measuring the cross section out to the mid 500s so far. Here is the gray is the systematic error, and the red is the next leading order calculations using the CTEC 6. So again, this is going to give the PDF uncertainty for the cross-section. This is the energy scale uncertainty here. You can see the energy scale uncertainty is still very large, just as it is for D0, because we're still working to try to understand in detail the run 2 detector to the same level or better that we did in run 1. And again, you can see that it's sort of a tendency for the cross-section to rise above the theoretical uncertainties, but given the experimental uncertainties, it's certainly too soon to make any type of conclusion. And again, with more work, you know, which there's a tremendous amount of work going on, then these systematic jet energy uncertainties are going to be reduced, you know, to the level of run one, or hopefully even better. So again, we have these PDF uncertainties that I talked about previously, you know. I won't go through the details again, but there's 20 free parameters in the fit, as I've said. So you end up with 40 PDFs that you can use for comparison to the jet cross-section for any cross-section, because you have 20 different directions, and you can go in the positive direction or you can go in the negative direction. So here's the run one cross-section from CDF. Here are the 40 error PDFs, and here are what they look like plotted on a linear scale. And again, you can see there's a very tight concentration here, as you would expect, right around where the data is. The data was used in the fit, but you can see that there are some outliers. In particular, there's one going up here and one coming down here. And it turns out that both of these are from one eigenvector, from eigenvector number 15. So 15 out of 20, so it's an eigenvector with a very small eigenvalue. So it shows you that even poorly determined directions, which you would think are going to be relatively unimportant, can have a big importance on particular cross-sections. In this case here, because you know high X gluon is going to directly affect the high ET jet cross-section. And again, this is discussed in a lot more detail in the paper that's shown there. And again, you can look at the contributions to the uncertainty of the cross-section from each of these 20 PDFs in the positive and negative direction. And again, it's eigenvector 15, which is causing the biggest contribution. So we have predictions for the uncertainty for the jet cross-sections for run 2. They're shown here. And note that in CDF, you know, we have these new N-plug calorimeters that are going to function or are functioning as well as the central calorimeters are. So they're going to be measuring jet cross-sections not only in the central region, but also in the forward regions, as D0 did in run 1. And this is important because if I have new physics, I expect it to be primarily central. But if I have a PDF explanation for some deviation in the cross-section, that PDF explanation has to work in every rapidity region. In fact, if you look in this forward rapidity region, you can see that this eigenvector 15 has an even stronger effect than it does in the central region. So by using the data in the different rapidity regions and in CDF and D0, we hope to get a much better handle on what the PDF uncertainties are for the jet cross-section in run 2. All right, so when do I have, about 2:40 or? What? More than that, 20 minutes, right? Okay. So there's a question that, you know, that I certainly have been thinking a lot about, and a lot of thought went into that this paper that's shown here, that it was on the previous slide, which is, if you're looking for new physics, the first thing that you have to do is try to make sure that your standard model physics is appropriate or is powerful enough to be able to describe all of the data. So one of the ways that people traditionally have done this, for example, is to look at the K factor, to look at next to leading order over leading order. And so, for example, if you look at a particular cross-section for ET of 70 GeV in this forward rapidity region, you know, here is the leading order cross-section. You can see it has the monotonic scale dependence like leading order cross-sections do. And if you go to next to leading order, you know, then it has this sort of parabolic shape, as you expect next to leading order cross-sections to do. And it crosses over, you know, very near a scale of half ET. And that's what we use for most of our cross-section comparisons, and so you have a K factor very close to 1 for this data point, and so you come away happy because you can say, even if it's, you know, not correct to think that way, that the next to leading order corrections are small. But if you look, for example, and again, this is something that troubled me a great deal whenever included these cross-sections from D0 into the CTEC FITS, is that if you look at 170 GeV in forward rapidity, you know, which is a region that's kinematically accessible, you can see that the K factor is much less than 1. So we've been trained to think that if the K factor is much greater than 1, then next leading order theory isn't working anymore. But if it's much less than 1, what conclusion do we have from that? And the answer is that it's really nothing significant. It's just that this parabolic curve has moved out because of the kinematics of the situation. It's at such high X. And so if I look here, the K factor is much less than 1, but the cross-section basically has the same value. So, you know, it's nothing to be alarmed about. What maybe is something to be alarmed about is I wouldn't want to choose much smaller scales, because then I can see that the cross-section becomes very unstable. Also, you might have to worry about edge of phase space effects. You know, the fact that if you're looking at very forward rapidities and high PTs, then you're looking at very high X values, you know, and do you need threshold resummation? You know, is that going to change the cross-sections very much at all? And the answer is, even in this very extreme bin, you know, at 170 GeV, rapidity 2 to 3, the effect of the threshold resummation is fairly minor. So it appears that next leading order QCD is, you know, going to be an adequate description for the jet data that we have in run 2. And again, you can apply the same exercise for the LHC, and you get the uncertainty predictions that are shown here. But again, by the time the LHC actually gets around to measuring these cross-sections, we hope that we're going to be able to significantly shrink the size of these theoretical errors due to PDFs as well as next to leading order. Another question that's of interest is that of the underlying event. So if I'm measuring a jet event, what I'm looking at is two partons colliding, producing high PT jets that are roughly back-to-back. But of course, that's not the only thing that's going on. We also have this underlying event. The rest of the partons are just kind of softly interacting with each other, which we think is similar to the soft collision of the type that takes place in a minimum bias event. Again, this is another case where it would be nice to include inclusive jets at MC at NLO, be able to describe accurately not only the hard scattering part of the cross-section, but also this soft or semi-hard part of the cross-section. So here's a run two study that's done by Rick Field, where he looks... you can do butterflies if you want. Run two, where he looks at the highest ET jet direction in the event. So the other jet is roughly opposite by 180 degrees. Then he looks in two directions that he calls transmax and transmin. And if you look at the transmin, it's this level here, and you can see that it's roughly independent of the ET of this leading jet, whereas the transmax region increases, you know, as the leading jet ET increases. So Rick is going to visit here during the week of February 9th. And so I don't know if Santa Barbara keeps track of these types of things, but I can guarantee you he is going to set the record for the most transparencies ever shown by any person in any stay. I keep telling him less is more, you know. The lesson never comes in. This is a very similar conclusion to a run one study where we've looked in the central rapidity region. Here is a lead jet here, and then you look at two cones at the same rapidity as the lead jet, plus or minus 90 degrees in phi, and again, define one as being the minimum cone, one as the maximum cone, and you see the same type of behavior, that the min cone is flat at a level similar to minimum bias, whereas the max cone increases with the ET of the lead jet. And again, the Monte Carlo programs, Herwig and Pythia, do a sort of reasonable description, you know, both the max and min cone, but neither of them describes, you know, every aspect completely right. Now, there's another question that came up during this analysis, which is the issue of interjet radiation, where you can measure how much energy is deposited far away from any of the high ET jets. This large-angle gluon radiation seems to be a topic of great interest recently. For example, Salam and Marchesini and collaborators, one of whom is sitting in the second row. So Herwig and Pythia should only have an approximation of this large angle soft radiation, but if you look at these plots here, you can see that they actually seem to agree fairly well, at least on the crude scales that I've shown it. So we're looking forward, even though, you know, we still have these large systematic errors for our jet cross-sections coming from the experimental side. We still have these large errors coming from the PDF side, which we hope to make smaller. We still look forward to next the leading order jet cross-sections. In particular, if we want to have next the leading order PDFs, which is a goal we certainly have for the LHC, then we need these jet cross-sections calculated at that level in order to make these higher order PDFs, you know, really, you know, truly next the leading order. And again, these topics of next the leading order are going to be the main topic in March of this workshop. There's another question, you know, it's often forgotten, but of jet algorithms. You know, that you're taking something that's happening at the partonic level, and either a next the leading order or next the leading order calculation, and trying to mimic what's happening at the hadronic level, you know, at your calorimeter cell level in the detector. And there's a lot of complications, you know, especially if you're using a cone algorithm, which is the main algorithm so far for both the CDF and D0. So I think I'll skip some of the details here, but, you know, I can refer you to this paper here on building better jet cone jet algorithms. And also, this will be discussed by Steve Ellis during a visit in March. All right, for heavy flavors, there's a lot of activity, and this is by far probably the largest group inside CDF, with the four papers already being submitted or published, six papers in preparation. There's 13 analyses moving towards a paper. You know, very nice B hadron masses, including the world's best mass measurement for B sub S and lambda sub B. lifetime measurements for B sub S and lambda sub B. And again, as Darian said, both collider experiments now have seen the X3872 that was originally found in Bell. This has already been submitted to PRL on December the 4th. One of the most interesting things, at least this is something that Michelangelo talks about all the time, which is the heavy flavor cross-section that was observed in run one. And if you look at the next leading order predictions a la 1997, then you can see that the B cross-section lies, actually for both CDF and D0, lies considerably above the theoretical predictions. Now, there is a work by Kachari and Nissan, resolving next to next leading logs, you know, a nice merger with next leading order QCD. Better treatment of fragmentation led to a better agreement, but again, the data is still above the theory, you know, for PT greater than 5 GeV. So I put that in bold and I underlined that because, you know, it is a small fraction of the cross-section because you're looking at B production at high PT. There's a new measurement that's recently come out that I'm sure Stefano is going to talk about in his talk, and probably Michelangelo will sneak it into his talk as well, measuring the B cross-section down to a PT of zero. So you're sensitive to the entire B cross-section. And what's found is that the data now is still a little bit larger than the theory, but it's of the same order. So it's a fairly good agreement between the data and the theory once you're measuring the total B cross-section and not that fraction of it at high PT. All right, W plus jets in run two. So this is a venue for precision tests of QCD plus measurements of backgrounds to new physics. So here's the W plus jet multiplicity distribution, goes out to six. And here's the difference between run one and run two. And again, you can see that we have about 40% more cross-section for W plus four jets at 1.96 TeV compared to 1.8. Again, most of the tools that we have for comparison are leading order, and of course, if you look at leading order, there's going to be a large scale uncertainty for the jet cross-sections, shown here in the jet multiplicity distribution, and in detail here, whenever we're looking at the PT distributions for jet 1, 2, 3, and 4. Now, next, the leading order is available for W plus 0, 1, 2 jets, which, again, John, I'm assuming, is going to talk about in his talk. And if I have time, I'll show a little bit later in this talk as well. So there's a lot of theoretical predictions for looking at W plus N jets. For example, AlpGen, Madgraf, I've already talked about this before. You feed them into Herwig and Pythia through the Lesueche interface for additional radiation hadronization. But there's some ambiguities, though, regarding the interfacing that may lead to double counting or undercounting in the final state. So far, CDF has used the MLM scheme for preventing this problem. Recently, Steve Morena and Peter Richardson have adopted the CKKW approach for use with W plus jets to solve this problem. And so this is in this paper here, and again, MLM, or Michelangelo, I'm sure, is going to talk about it in his talk as well. And just as an advertisement, Steve Morena and I have organized a series of workshops, mostly at Fermilab, but also at Durham on these types of issues. And all the talks can be found at this web address here. And this is going to be the primary activity that's going to take place in February in this workshop with all of the matrix element and Monte Carlo people here at one time, just to try to come up with a better understanding for these types of predictions for run two. So just show this slide here. This is my transition slide because you're looking for backgrounds to W plus jets events, and you can see that the backgrounds are pretty small for low jet multiplicities, mostly due to, you know, what's called QCD background. But if you look at the high jet multiplicity, then you have a significant background from top production. Which brings my next topic, which is, and the last topic, which is top physics in run two. So step one, rediscover the top. And once that's done, measure the top cross-section as precisely as possible, the top mass, and as many precision measurements as your data sample is going to allow you to do. So everyone knows there's three classes of signals depending on how the W decays: dileptone events, lepton plus jet events, or all hadronic. And again, because of its relatively large mass, you end up with a 30% larger cross-section in run two than you had in run one. So here's a typical event, right, which everyone always shows, which means this is the nicest event that we have, in which you can see that there are two jets that have clear secondary vertices. So there's very little ambiguity in this event. And, of course, if you're looking for the top, you have to try to separate it from the background. So you have to try to use the tools at your disposal in order to determine, you know, what is top and what is just W plus jets or WBB bar. So we have better tools in run 2 now than we did in run 1, but still not exactly what we would like to have. So for example, if I look at the jet multiplicity distribution in association with W events, these are events in which I have B tagged. So I expect to have just sort of WBB bar type of processes in these first two bins, but it's in these last two bins that I expect to find the top signal. And I want to look at any excess over my predicted backgrounds and call that my top signal. So we have leading order cross sections that we can use for these final states with 3 and 4 jets, but we need something better than leading order. So in CDF, we've used something called method 2. So don't ask me what method 1 is. And so it uses a mixture of data and theory. So you use a program like Alpjin and Herwig to estimate the fraction of W plus NJET events that contain 2 Bs. And then you take this theoretical prediction at leading order and multiply it by the data. And from that, predict how many WBB bar plus 1 jet, 2 jet events that you expect. So you'd like to know how this ratio depends upon order and perturbation theory. This is done at leading order. The choice, the renormalization and factorization scales, the number of jets, kinematic cuts, etc. So we can investigate some of these issues for n equals 2 using MCFM. So here's something else to add to the MC at NLO wish list, which is adding W plus 2 jets. Are you writing this down? W plus 2 jets, you know, WBB bar, because the matrix elements already exist, and it's only going to take 6 months of Stefano's labor or whatever. You already have such a backlog now, though, so. And homework for March, you know, not for you, but just for the other people, is to calculate W plus 3 and 4 jets to next the leading order, so that by the time you finish the WBB bar, you'll have something else to look forward to. So this is actually subject of a forthcoming paper by John Campbell and myself, and since we're going to be at the same place, the same time for a couple of weeks, hopefully we can finish it during that time. So I should finish up soon, shouldn't I?
Right.
Okay. So I think John's probably going to talk about this, maybe some of his talks, so I'll just sort of skip through. Just say that we're looking at things as well as we can at next to leading order. Let me show this, actually, because this is interesting. This is looking at the ratio of WBB bar over W plus 2 jets to next to leading order using MCFM. And John is actually the first person that I know of who's actually implemented the Lesueche Accord with this new version, you know, into his program. So here's the PDF uncertainty for this calculation. So it's, you know, still slower than doing just the central value, but not that much slower. All right, if you look at the top cross-section from B tags, again, you're looking out here for sort of an excess. Come up with a cross-section of 4.5 plus or minus 1.4 plus or minus 0.8 picobarons. You can also look, for example, at the kinematics. So for example, you expect different kinematics for things like the sum ET of the 3 leading jets or the leading jet ET, you know, if you're looking at top compared to, say, something like WBB bar. So there's a number of different variables that you can use. You can see what the signal fraction is, and you end up with a somewhat larger cross-section of 6.9 picobarons using all of these different techniques. So again, looking at all the top cross-sections, this is a summary, including D0 data, D0 cross-sections as well as CDF. And again, you know, you expect an increase in the cross-section of 30%. You know, some of the CDF cross-sections, you know, are a little bit higher. But one, just counting the number of B-tagged events, is still lower, but that could be a statistical fluctuation. You can also look at the top mass and see one of the advantages of getting electronic talks is that you can change it, you know, while the previous speakers are talking. So from run 2, you know, we have a value of 177.5, and I'm very happy that that's in the direction that Guido prefers, and we'll try to work as hard on that as we can. Systematic error, again, this is still dominated by the systematic error of the jet energy scale. And so, of course, the more we know about the jet energy scale, the smaller the systematic error is going to be. All right, expectations pre-LHC. So I think everyone knows that the laboratory has scaled back the luminosity element estimate from 15 inverse femtobarns. So the new number is going to be from 3.25 to 6.15 by fiscal year 08, 4.4 to 8.6 by fiscal year 09. As a consequence, the silicon upgrades for both CDF and D0 have been canceled. So again, here's the two predictions. If you're a CDF or D0 silicon detector, you're probably going to die, at least to some extent, somewhere in this range. Again, Mike is going to be here on Wednesday. He's going to talk in more detail about the status of Fermilab. And of course, this has an implication for the Higgs sensitivity, but I'm just going to show this slide here and why Ming is going to talk about the implications in his talk, which I believe is on Wednesday or Thursday. All right, I think I'll stop here.
Thanks very much. It's very extended and interesting talk. And
extended?
I mean, covering the whole subject very interestingly.
You set the bar pretty high.
So, comments, questions? Ziggy?
You touched on using different jet algorithms.
Right.
And it's for a long time that, of course, this classical cone algorithm is known to be somehow not the ideal thing to compare between experiment and theory. Now, how far are the plans to use some more maybe modern KT-like check algorithms or something like that in the future, where you have a better match between theory and experiment, and between the two experiments, of course?
I think, well, first of all, you know, we've had a series of workshops between CDF and D0. We want to make sure that we're on the same page as much as possible regarding, you know, both the cone jet and the KT algorithms. So we have a run-to algorithm that, you know, actually nominally we're both supposed to use, but many of the CDF results are still using the one run-one algorithm, you know, so far. Both experiments plan to quote cross-sections both with the KT algorithm and the cone algorithm. There's a lot of work, though, using the KT algorithm in a Hadron Collider type of environment. So it really is going to be the cone algorithms that come out first. In addition, we still have this puzzle that we don't really understand from the D0 result from run one, where they see, you know, good agreement, you know, with the predictions. In fact, that has to be good agreement, right? Because that data was used for making the parton distributions. But, you know, good agreement using the cone algorithm, but, you know, a deviation when using the KT algorithm, which, you know, as you say, should be superior. So that's still something to, you know, that we have to think about. And it's not clear in my mind whether the KT algorithm is superior for a Hadron Collider environment when comparing to a fixed order parton level calculation. So again, hopefully that's something we can get into in this workshop as well.
So further comments or questions? Then thank you again. Very nice talk.